Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We will begin with the Nunes memo, which for the first time has the House Intelligence Committee releasing classified information to the public, which is clearly designed for the partisan purpose of scuttling the Mueller investigation, using the drumbeat of the Fox News propaganda machine to reinforce the lie that Trump is a victim of the Russia hoax and is under attack by the so-called deep state. Joshua Geltzer, the founding executive director of the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection, who served as senior director for counterterrorism at the National Security Council and as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for National Security at the Department of Justice, joins us. We'll discuss his article at Just Security, You Don't Need to Know What's in the Nunes Memo to Worry About Its Release, and the move by Nunes and the Republicans to block the rebuttal by the committee's Democratic majority so that the public will only get Nunes's headline-grabbing, cherry-picked, sensationalized version cobbled together to support the Trump talking points without context or any regard for the truth. Then we'll examine further this dramatic escalation in the war the Trump administration and their Republican enablers are waging on the DOJ and the FBI, and speak with Mark Zaid, a Washington-based attorney who handles national security cases and has represented clients ranging from high-profile members of Congress to covert CIA operations officers. We will discuss how Nunes and Trump are targeting Rod Rosenstein on the bogus grounds he asked for an extension of a FISA warrant on Carter Page, who had previously been caught on surveillance being recruited by two Russian spies who were arrested. Then finally, we will try to assess why Trump has again given Vladimir Putin a free pass by not imposing new sanctions on Russia, called for by an overwhelming majority in Congress that Trump reluctantly signed into law last year. Instead, Trump put out a list of 210 senior Russian political figures and oligarchs that appears to have been lifted from a Forbes list of billionaires. William Pomerantz, the deputy director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center, who also teaches Russian law at Georgetown University's Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies, joins us to analyze why Trump is so soft on the Russians. And joining us now is Joshua Geltzer, who is the founding executive director of the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection, as well as a visiting professor in law at Georgetown University Law Center. He's also a fellow in New America's International Security Program and served as senior director for counterterrorism at the National Security Council staff, having served previously as deputy legal advisor to the National Security Council and as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for National Security at the United States Department of Justice. He has an article at Just Security, You Don't Need to Know What's in the Nunes Memo to Worry About Its Release. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Geltzer.
Thanks so much for having me.
And my fear, Joshua, is that this memo that Nunes has released, and I can't help to suspect there's some collusion with the White House, since that was happened previously with him prior to when he had to step down as chair of the Senate House Intelligence Committee. But that notwithstanding, it seems to me that with all the publicity and the drumbeat preceding this about a secret society within the so-called deep state, do you think the American people will basically just swallow the headlines? And if and when there's a rebuttal, if the Democratic rebuttal ever gets to see the light of day, by that time the damage will be done?
I do worry about that. I worry that this memo is being put out and indeed rushed out to capture those headlines, to project some sort of cloud or doubt over the work of the Justice Department and the FBI as part of the Justice Department. And in particular, I worry about the role of, just as you pointed towards, the White House in this, because whatever the view of the White House is about the memo ultimately being released or not released, at a minimum, it's the executive branch's job to protect national security information, to review a document like this, which I understand is currently marked and treated as classified, for information that should be at least redacted if the memo is going to be put out. And I'm particularly concerned about an executive branch that seems uninterested in playing that important function in its rush to see this memo come out.
But surely there's complicity with the legislative branch, because both the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and the new director of the FBI went to Speaker Ryan's office and begged him to weigh in and restrain Nunez from doing what Nunez was determined to do and what he has already done. And we're just waiting to hear from the president, who will obviously release it after the State of the Union.
I think that's fair. I don't think folks on the Hill who have been complicit in this are entitled to get off the hook either. They too have a role in this seemingly rushed and unbalanced release of this memo, especially in contrast to the other memo that the minority members of the House Intel Committee seem to want released. And at the end of the day, it's the responsibility of government to treat information appropriately, to give the public fair, informed understandings of issues, and to treat with sensitivity, in particular, issues that have long been, most of the time, above the political fray. And I consider law enforcement work and the collection of intelligence to keep our nation safe an issue that at least should be kept above the political fray. And when instead that type of stuff gets subjected to the push and pull of very personal partisan politics, I think there's a lot of blame to go around.
And again, I'm speaking with Joshua Geltzer, who's a founding executive director of the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection, as well as a visiting professor of law at Georgetown University's Law Center. He's also a fellow at the New America Foundation's International Security Program and served as senior director for counterterrorism at the National Security Council staff, having served previously as deputy legal advisor to the National Security Council and as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for National Security at the U.S. Department of Justice. He has an article at Just Security, "You Don't Need to Know What's in the Nunez Memo to Worry About Its Release." And of course, I believe, wasn't it a Deputy Attorney General who spoke out against this release and warned against it being damaging to national security and, I imagine, what they call sources and methods? Apparently, Donald Trump was fuming about it on Air Force One since he had appointed this Deputy Attorney General. So it's reasonable to assume, isn't it, that the rank and file inside the DOJ and the FBI are pretty appalled about what's happening.
You're right. It was actually the Assistant Attorney General, Stephen Boyd, the Assistant Attorney General for Legislative Affairs, but Trump's own political appointee, who called release of this memo without an opportunity for DOJ and FBI to review it extraordinarily reckless. That's Boyd's words, not mine. And what I think it reflects is, as you say, an institutional responsibility on the part of the Justice Department, of course, including FBI, to look at a document like this, if it's going to be put out, and see whether there are portions of it that, for example, would reveal the sources and methods through which our nation learns about threats to our country, about foreign actors, and overall tries to keep our citizens safe. I think that's something that the bureaucracy, so to speak, would very much be behind. I know when I was at DOJ, that was a supreme responsibility. And so I think Boyd's letter reflected, as you say, what's got to be the impulse of many folks who worked on these issues for a long time, which is to see this process as really deficient in many respects.
But as far as we know, what this memo is about, and obviously it hasn't been released, but the press reports indicate that it's about an extension of FISA warrants on Carter Page. And months prior to this request by Rob Rosenstein to get this extension, Russian intelligence agents had tried to recruit Carter Page, and the Russian spies were actually arrested. So I can't for the life of me understand why there's anything controversial about the idea that you want to continue surveillance on Carter Page. He's a walking kind of, I was going to say honey trap, but I can't think of the right word. He's a walking magnet for Russian spies.
Like you, I haven't seen the memo itself, but it's not clear to me what smoking gun it will purport to reveal. As you say, the reports seem to suggest that it will somehow call into question the basis, again, based on what's been suggested publicly so far, the basis for collection against Page. But as you also point out, there are reasons to think that collection rested on solid foundations. And from the statement made by Representative Schiff last night after the House Intelligence Committee voted, he and others seem to think that the portrayal in this short memo about the basis for that coverage is really not an accurate portrayal and doesn't do justice, so to speak, to what the law enforcement community was working with at whatever point they initiated or perhaps renewed coverage against him as a target of intelligence collection. But when it comes out, I worry that it will seize headlines, and I worry that the nuances may be lost, especially when the other memo that Representative Schiff sought to have released is not coming out, too, to, I assume, tell a somewhat different story.
And that, of course, raises the possibility that that rebuttal in this partisan kind of intensity that's going on in our extremely polarized and tribal politics, it would seem that it's not out of the question that that could be leaked, and that in itself would not help anybody. But I, on the other hand, one could sort of understand the frustration that the Democrats feel that Nunes and Trump have done an end run around them to basically essentially mislead the American public. Because at the end of the day, none of this activity on the part of our president has made any sense. From day one, if he was completely innocent of the charges that all of the U.S. intelligence agencies came to a consensus on, that Russia did interfere, the extent to which he was involved in that, in collusion with that, is what's in question. But he never wanted to clear the air. He's never at any point acted like an innocent man. He's acting like somebody that's got something to hide. And this is doubling down on that perception that's already in place.
And I would add to that that in a forward-looking way, there's a puzzle here. If I were at the White House these days and looking to protect our nation from outside threats, I'd be worried about the upcoming midterms. I'd want to have focused intensely at the highest levels of government on how do we ensure that the most sacred pillar of our democracy, our federal elections, are secure from foreign interference, whether that's through actual collusion, so to speak, with a candidate or a party, or whether that's through the somewhat more diffuse issue of using social media, for example, to polarize and divide our society. In all of its manifestations, this would be a top priority. And yet, reports suggest that there's been no cabinet-level meeting on this general issue, and there really hasn't been a lot of work done to focus on it. There's one report that FBI has stood up a new task force focused on these issues, and if that's right, I think that's praiseworthy. But as with most national security challenges, this seems like an issue that requires efforts across the federal government, or at least the national security parts of the federal government, and it certainly requires White House leadership, and it's concerning not to see that emerging.
Well, we know that the Democrats put out a report recently. The Republicans did not sign on to it. And that raises the question of why are not the Republicans concerned about Russia interfering in 2018 and 2020 when it's been made clear that they did so in the 2016 election. So, and I have to add to that, surely, that just during the shutdown where both sides were trying to spin the narrative of who was responsible for the government shutdown, Russian bots and troll farms were pushing out the hashtag Schumer shutdown. So it's pretty clear who the Russians are working for still.
I think that's right. This problem hasn't gone away. It isn't going away. You were kind enough to mention the piece I did on the Nunes memo for Just Security. I wrote a piece there about a month ago trying to lay out what I called a checklist for addressing foreign election meddling. And there are different institutional actors with different responsibilities here. There are the tech companies themselves, who I think have recognized that they should and need to do more in this space. There's Congress, which could arm our government with new laws, new tools at their disposal to get at this problem. And then, of course, there is the executive branch, which, even in the absence of new authorities, could do a better job and devote more resources to using the authorities they already have to understanding this problem, helping inform the public about the problem, even helping to inform the tech companies themselves about what new trends and trajectories are emerging so that those companies can address them in some of the ways they've been exploring about how to do so. And it's concerning concerning not to see, in particular, the executive branch taking action on this issue, because I think the 2016 election revealed, in some ways, a new form of vulnerability at the intersection of our democracy and the technology associated with modern communications platforms like social media. And that's a challenge our government should be taking on and doing so quickly with those midterms under a year away.
So just to wrap up, though, we started out suggesting that Nunes is able to put this memo out, which is apparently, from what we know, is cherry-picked classified information that's really aimed at, I think, pretty clearly at going after Rob Rosenstein. And that suggests that that may be a part of Trump's agenda. If you get rid of Rosenstein, then Trump could put somebody in or elevate somebody within the DOJ that might be more compliant. And that's not to suggest that Rachel Brand is in any way a kind of Trump toady, although apparently she's quite conservative. But that is on a lot of people's mind, isn't it? They see this maneuver of Nunes having real implications because it does seem to target Rob Rosenstein.
I think there's reason to worry about that. It's at least based on the public reports, it seems like that may be part of what's intended by this memo's release. And in part, that would be unfortunate because it would begin to get at the foundations of what seems to be work by the special counsel that the Deputy Attorney General has allowed to continue unhindered, and it's important work. But even beyond that and broader than that, the idea that our Congress would release a document intended to undermine a particular leader of our law enforcement community or of our law enforcement institutions generally, that just strikes me as deeply unhealthy for our system and frankly, a long way from the professionals that I worked with at the Justice Department and FBI who work with sensitive tools like FISA collection authorities, but do so with real care and a real sensitivity to the law and a real effort to use them within the bounds of the law. And to the extent Congress provides its oversight function, that's a critical function. But to release a memo aimed at casting aspersions on that work, that strikes me as a very politically charged way to go about this.
Well, just in closing, obviously President Trump is not your usual president, and he was schooled by his mentor, Roy Cohn. I think he has a kind of slash-and-burn mentality, and he's used the law as a weapon to protect himself. But based upon leaning on Comey to be loyal, etc., there's an indication that he basically wants law enforcement people to protect him as opposed to investigate him. So I'm trying to think of an analogy, given that we started out talking about how Devin Nunes is likely to win the PR battle, because by the time the dust settles, the headlines will be what people believe in without access to the correction by the Democrats that wasn't allowed to be released. So would this be like, in terms of Trump's attitude to the law and what's going on here, or at least seems to be what the subtext is, would this be like if you get a speeding ticket from a cop, then you turn around and investigate the policeman for adultery or something like that?
It's hard to find an analogy. The presidency and the special counsel, there's so much that's distinctive, maybe even unique, that I'd want to think through the right comparison if there even is one. But I think you're getting at something important, which is we've long thought of the law as not a tool to be wielded against political opponents in this country. The law is something distinct from politics and hopefully above it. And you really need to go back, I think, to the rhetoric of the 2016 campaign and the idea of then-candidate Trump and some of the folks who were quite vocal in supporting him. You go back to them talking about lock her up when it came to Hillary. And that idea of lock her up as a response to a political opponent is that's very different from our tradition. And to see what has flowed from that infusion of law enforcement rhetoric into the domain that once was and should be a space for political and policy debate, I think we are now reaping some of that, and I think it's really worrisome.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Joshua Geltzer.
pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you again. I've been speaking with Joshua Gelzer, who's the founding executive director of the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection, as well as a visiting professor of law at Georgetown University's Law Center. He's also a fellow in New America's International Security Program and served as senior director for counterterrorism at the National Security Council staff, having served previously as deputy legal advisor to the National Security Council and as counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for National Security at the United States Department of Justice. And he has an article at Just Security. You don't need to know what's in the Nunez memo to worry about its release. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining further the dramatic escalation in the war the Trump administration and their Republican enablers are waging on the DOJ and the FBI. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mark Zaid, who is a Washington-based attorney handling cases involving national security, security clearances, government investigations, media, the Freedom of Information Act, and whistleblowing. And his clients have ranged from high-profile members of Congress to covert CIA operations officers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Zaid.
Thank you, Ian. It's my pleasure.
And I'm astounded. I mean, I know how the system works and that by releasing this memo, this bogus memo that Devin Nunes has put together, and I'm sure there's some collusion with the White House, as there was in earlier occasion when Nunes was forced to step down as chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. My sense is that what's going to happen here is that after the State of the Union, Trump's going to allow it to be released. The Fox News and other right-wing media have already been beating the drum about this idea that there's a secret society within the deep state. So people are primed for this, and that the headlines will just go out there. And since the Democrats weren't able to release their rebuttal, these charges will probably hang. And, you know, I don't know what kind of percentage of the American people, but a good percentage of the American people are going to believe this nonsense that Nunes is putting out.
Well, you know, we live in an interesting time, don't we? And so just one thing. So Devin Nunes, he didn't step down as the chair, but he was supposed to have recused himself from aspects of the Russian investigation. He's remained chair the entire time in the Trump administration and slightly before then, whenever Mike Rogers had left Congress, who was his predecessor. And I'll say I've worked closely with Devin Nunes on matters before, and I never anticipated he would act in the ways that he has since Trump took office, and I'm not even going to speculate as to why. I'll just say I'm dumbfounded by it. But this process has been incredibly strange, is probably many of words that can be used. This is the first time in the 41-year history of the House Select Committee on Intelligence that this little-known provision in the House rules has been exercised to vote for the public disclosure of classified information. And I want to say that again, public disclosure of classified information. It is my view, as someone who has been dealing with classification, declassification issues for a quarter century, including testifying before Congress, you know, lots of litigation, lots of administrative actions, expert witnesses status, that this vote does not declassify the memorandum that the Republican-controlled HPC, as we call it, has authored. And in the same time, they have voted to deny the Democrats, and I'll say I'm an independent, always have been, have denied the Democrats an opportunity to release their own counterpoint memo about this, to contradict, supposedly, whatever talking points are in this Republican memo. The saddest part of this is that for, I'm not going to say the first time, but let's say the worst I have ever seen in 25 years, the House Select Committee on Intelligence has become so partisan that there's a clear split down the middle of each side. This has been generally, historically, one of the committees, if not the committee, where partisanship was set aside so that the oversight committee can do its job to conduct legitimate and needed oversight of the intelligence community, which in this case would include the FBI, since it's the one responsible for compiling much of the information for the FISA warrant applications.
Well, but Devin Nunes worked on the Trump campaign. I mean, that makes him, I think, more partisan than normal, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, that's hard to say. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Certainly lots of members have worked on the different transition campaigns, et cetera, or announced that they would support a particular candidate. But we still have, I mean, there's other members, obviously, on the HPSI, and you've got, you know, every single one of them went down party line in voting to release this memo, which is unheard of, and denying the counterpoint memo, which is virtually unheard of, too. In the past, let's, for example, use the CISI, the counterpart Senate Intelligence Committee, their report on torture in dealing with the CIA a few years ago. There was a majority report that was declassified. There was a minority report, the Democrats, that was declassified. And there was a CIA report that addressed both the majority and the minority report. That is typically how the intelligence committees have operated to get all the information out there in a safe and unclassified manner, which is not what we are seeing right now.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Zaid, who's a Washington-based attorney handling cases involving national security, security clearances, government investigations, media, the Freedom of Information Act, and whistleblowing. And his clients have ranged from high-profile members of Congress to covert CIA operations officers. But prior to this Nunes memo, both Rod Rosenstein and Chris Wray, the new head of the FBI, went to Speaker Ryan's office and begged him to intervene and stop Nunes from releasing this memo, and apparently that didn't work. A lot of analysts think that this memo is actually designed to basically target Rod Rosenstein, and from what we know, and obviously we don't know the details yet, because President Trump is going to probably release this thing on Wednesday after the State of the Union, but from what we've learned in press reports is that it may involve an extension of a FISA warrant on Carter Page. And of course, Carter Page, several months prior to that, was under FBI surveillance, under their counterintelligence surveillance, because two Russian spies were trying to recruit him. And these Russian spies were subsequently arrested. So it seems perfectly reasonable to me, not that I'm a great fan of FISA and surveillance, that the FBI had good reason to put Carter Page under surveillance. And I'm not sure it has anything to do with the Steele memo.
Right. And how amazing is this that we have the Republican-controlled Department of Justice and FBI who are arguing and advocating that the Republican-controlled House not release this memo because of concerns of not only revealing classified information, but also in revealing FISA techniques that have never been revealed before. In fact, if there is a mention in this memo that Carter Page is the individual whose privacy is at issue, this would be, from what I understand, the first time that the U.S. government has ever acknowledged an individual who has been the target of a FISA investigation, other than, of course, if the case led to a criminal prosecution and there was a need to do so, which that does happen. But, you know, in fact, if those who watched today Paul Ryan's press conference, the first questions, if not I think the only questions asked of him, had to do with the HPSI's action to release this memo. And he said that, wow, this has nothing to do, of course, with the Mueller investigation or Russia investigation. Now, I'm not sure what world he's living in, because clearly it has everything to do. But you're absolutely right. The timeline is suggesting that, in fact, whatever FISA warrant was obtained against Carter Page or involving Carter Page predated the Steele dossier so that it might not have relied on it at all. And if, in fact, it continued every 90 days, these FISA warrants had to be extended, not just extended, but had to be shown again to a sitting U.S. federal district judge that information in the original warrant application actually led to obtaining information to support the continuation of the FISA warrant for another period of 90 days. What many people don't understand, and I'm going to have to include quite a number of members of Congress, unfortunately, is how FISA actually operates and the amount of detail that goes into these applications, the amount of substantiated and credible details that have to go into these applications before a district judge, and the majority of the district judges who sit currently on the FISA court are all Republican-appointed district judges. So we don't yet know which judge approved this particular warrant or extended it, as the case might be. But we are seeing this really phenomenal situation of pitting Republicans against Republicans. And as I have been saying to members of the media, there's a war brewing here between the House Select Committee on Intelligence and the federal agencies that it oversees, because we have never seen a breakdown of trust like we ever have before now.
But if this war is breaking out, the people that are doing the blitzkrieg, that are on the offensive, are the Trump administration. Donald Trump does not play by the normal rules. He was schooled by his mentor, Roy Cohn. He's a slash and burn kind of guy. I mean, the only analogy I could give is that, you know, if a cop pulls you over, gives you a speeding ticket, you then turn around and investigate the cop for adultery or something. I mean, it's amazing how the guy that's under investigation is trying to choose who his investigators are.
Well, and I mean, time will tell about the connections that's going on between Devin Nunes and any of the other members of the HPC, right, and the White House itself. Right. I mean, there's a lot of question marks, of course, legitimate questions that want to be asked with respect to the relationship between why is this action happening and this action not happening, as it might be. But, I mean, you're right. There are very few rules here. I mean, here it is. You know, Trump, there's, at least as far as I think the end of today, was that there's no indication that Trump has even seen this memo, read this memo. It's 4 pages. From all we know, apparently 4 pages is way, way beyond his normal reading length of what he likes to see. And this is by reports coming from Republicans on the inside. And so here it was, he's advocating for the release of this memo before he even knows what's inside of it, because he seems to believe, and is probably true in this sense, that it would serve his individual interests. Well, that's not what the President of the United States is supposed to base his or her decisions on, unfortunately. National security is supposed to control. And this provision that the House has used to release this, I mean, historically, it's amazing. I think the folks who would have drafted it back in the late 70s would be aghast as to what has happened politically, agenda-wise, ideologically, by the current sitting members. Because the whole premise of it was designed to prevent the executive branch from undertaking systemic Fourth Amendment abuses like it did in the 50s and 60s that led to the creation of the Church Committee, the Pike Committee, and the Rockefeller Commission, all three congressional entities that in the 1970s investigated and substantiated significant Fourth Amendment, Sixth Amendment violations by the U.S. government. And if you read the provision, it makes it very clear that that's what they're trying to be able to identify, that if they found another type of that egregious behavior, which I don't think is what we're seeing here, that they would reveal classified information in order to determine that the public interest outweighed even the privacy rights of those who were being violated by the executive branch. But that was before the FISA court was created. That was before the House and Select and Senate committees were created. You know, the oversight that exists now, which may still be lacking, the argument can be definitely made, is far greater than what existed 40 years ago. So that's why I come to the conclusion this is a partisan political abuse of this provision that is designed to solely serve the interests, in this case, of the Trump administration.
But going back to your war analogy, I was just in the last couple of minutes, it would seem to me that it is Nunes and the Trump administration that are declaring war on the DOJ and the FBI. And I don't think there's an example of the FBI and the DOJ being attacked by the executive branch in this way. This seems unprecedented, and I'm not sure they're prepared for it. And after all, Trump is their boss. So how do they stand up to him?
And in the same party, I'm sure there have been instances where the White House has where the Congress has criticized, perhaps, clearly. But the White House obviously appoints the Attorney General, the leadership in these organizations, the FBI director. I mean, to make the argument that they are part of this deep state, as you've mentioned, which is what the right-wing media has been seizing on, which I would point out is without making a moral equivalence that they are, you know, equivalent to Nazis in Nazi Germany or in the early 30s with National Socialists. But it is that type of tactic that was first used to start swaying public opinion against the establishment, against the organizations inside the government in order to destabilize them. I mean, it's a horrific concern that we should all have in trying to understand exactly what is going on here, based by the Trump administration. And I can't imagine that, including, you know, up to Attorney General Sessions, as he's trying to figure out why is his own boss attacking his department as being complicit in, as they allege, egregious violations that, quite frankly, would involve numerous people, including the judiciary, which is, again, another thing that the National Socialists did in order to destabilize the government, to give power to the Nazis as they gain ground. I'm not trying to make an analogy. That's where we're going. I don't think we're going that way. It's a completely different system as it was now versus the 30s. But these are initial stages that we do see as to how leaders turn to dictators.
Well, Mark Zaid, I thank you for that sobering analysis, and let's talk again.
I would love it. Anytime, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Zaid, who's a Washington-based attorney handling cases involving national security, security clearances, government investigations, media, the Freedom of Information Act, and whistleblowing. And his clients have ranged from high-profile members of Congress to covert CIA operations officers. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back trying to assess why Trump has again given Vladimir Putin a free pass by not imposing new sanctions called for by Congress. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is William Pomerantz, who's the Deputy Director of the Cannon Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. He also teaches Russian law at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Pomerantz.
Glad to be back.
And what do you make of Donald Trump basically giving Putin yet again a free pass? I mean, the Congress had mandated that by Monday he impose sanctions and draw up a list of those that should be sanctioned. And he pretty much did neither. He did draw up a list, but not of people to be sanctioned, but a kind of, you know, what do they call, name and shame list, which apparently came from Forbes magazine. Basically, it's just a group of the richest Russians, along with some of the Siloviki, the ex-intelligence people that Putin has turned into billionaires. But again, I'm absolutely mystified. Do you have any insight into why Trump keeps giving Putin a free pass?
Well, I'm going to first address the issue of the actual legislation and what was required. The legislation itself required that President Trump, within 180 days of the passage of the law, produce a list. And he has produced a list. The list is both classified and unclassified. And it is true that the unclassified list looks pretty much like a cut-and-paste job from the Forbes list and from the Russian government. We don't know what is in the classified list, so we don't know if, in fact, he included more details in that list. And the larger question is, well, there are several larger questions. It appears, on the surface at least, from President Trump's perspective, that he observed the letter of the law, but not the spirit of the law. But the law itself did not demand that additional sanctions be imposed. And therefore, it appears, as I said, that he's abided by the requirement to produce a list. It just doesn't appear that the list was produced in the spirit of what was broadly intended to be an attempt to put more pressure on Russia in the aftermath of developments in Ukraine and the elections.
So do you think that the Congress expected more than just a list, that they wanted action on that list? And what's the point here, particularly when it's such an amorphous kind of list of rich Russians, including some of them that own soccer teams in London, etc.? I don't understand why you would produce a list and not act on it, particularly if the intention is to name and shame. It doesn't seem like Vladimir Putin is affected by anything he does, that the U.S. does. In fact, he again is telling the Russian people that I'm taking the high road. We thought about retaliating against the Americans, but we're going to be the adults, in effect. So that seems to be the way he's playing it.
President Putin has played it very well, and he's basically said that on the one hand, it's unfair how the U.S. government shames people, but at the same time, he and several prominent Russian politicians have kind of laughed off this particular list because it has no teeth and no substance. So in that sense, yet again, I think it's fair to say that President Trump hasn't lived up to the spirit of the law. He has introduced other sanctions against individuals involved in the supply of arms and so forth in Ukraine. There is a question, as you mentioned, as to how Congress will respond, and we don't know that answer yet. But in many ways, Congress is unlikely to criticize President Trump in the naming of in the production of this list, because Republicans aren't looking to shame Donald Trump in his activities with Ukraine. The broader purpose of the law that was passed, in which this particular provision is attached, is to make sure that President Trump could not unilaterally withdraw the sanctions against Russia. Under the previous regime, as implemented by President Obama, the sanctions were introduced by executive order, which gave the president ultimate flexibility as to keep them or to withdraw them. And as we've learned through the Mueller investigation, it appears that Mr. Flynn had every intention of withdrawing these sanctions. And that's why this legislation was passed. So this legislation, of which this one list is a small part of legislation, was primarily to prevent President Trump from unilaterally withdrawing the sanctions. The name and shame list was supposed to put added pressure on oligarchs and related government ministries, and quite clearly President Trump and his administration decided that they weren't going to use this opportunity to put extra pressure on the oligarchs.
And again, I'm speaking with William Pomerantz, who's the Deputy Director of the Cannon Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., and he also teaches Russian law at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. So this, of course, is all happening at the same time that Devin Nunes, the former, and I think he's reappointed himself as the chair of the House Intelligence Committee. He's apparently cherry-picked some classified information, essentially, I think, to build a case against Rob Rosenstein, who had asked for an extension of a FISA warrant against Carter Page, who had already been under FBI counterintelligence surveillance because the couple of Russian spies had attempted to recruit him, and the U.S. arrested these Russian spies. So it's a pretty extraordinary situation. And again, it begs the same question that I've asked you before, Will, and that is the question, why is Trump giving Putin a free pass? Why is Nunes working so hard to destroy the Mueller investigation?
Because they don't like what it's producing. They clearly don't want the Mueller investigation to reach conclusions about either collusion or obstruction of justice, or to discover the sources of Donald Trump's business dealings with oligarchs from not only Russia, but from Ukraine and Azerbaijan and other parts of the post-Soviet space. So there is a concerted effort to discredit that investigation. And indeed, the Nunes report, which I think is going to come out, is going to be far more controversial than this failure to produce an actual list of additional sanctioned persons. That's going at the heart of the investigation that Donald Trump wants stopped. And therefore, I think that will immediately overshadow what occurred in terms of this production of the list. Why does President Trump apparently seem to want to give a free pass to Vladimir Putin? He's never fully explained that, but clearly that's been part of his campaign from the beginning. And there's various sorts of speculation as to why it is that, you know, having grown up in the Cold War, he genuinely wants to have better relations. Or is it because he's had extensive business dealings and allegedly that the Russians have something on him? That is something that we don't know. That is subject to lots of speculation. And I think what Congressman Nunes wants to do is to discredit those reports and discredit any attempt to undermine the Trump presidency going forward. And that appears to be what he wants to do. Obviously, releasing a Republican port and not allowing an accompanying Democratic report to be released, which criticizes that report, is going to cause all types of controversy and will, I think, dominate the headlines far more, again, than this specific list about potentially sanctioned oligarchs.
Yes, and indeed, there's a possibility that the Democrats might leak their list, which would be a risky thing to do. But it does highlight the kind of polarization in this country. You've almost got two separate narratives going on here. You've got about 30 to 35% of the country in the kind of Fox News bubble who believe that everything, all other news is fake news, and everything that they put out in support of Donald Trump is the truth. And many analysts that I've spoken to, an awful lot of analysts of Russia who talk about Surkov, the so-called political technologist of Vladimir Putin's, and how we developed this kind of cynical approach to the media. And it's worth noting, of course, that the demonstrations that took place in Russia on Sunday were not covered by state media in the way that Fox News doesn't cover a breaking story in the New York Times that's unfavorable to Donald Trump.
Yes, it is very disconcerting to find parallels between how Russia covers news and how certain segments of the U.S. media also covers news. That's the challenge of our time. The challenge of our time is to try to expose what is real news and what is fake news. And I leave it up to, you know, the representatives of the media to see how they're going to be able to counteract the narrative that there is a deep state, that everything is being done to harm the Trump presidency, and that we need to clean out the FBI. They are undercutting and undermining one of the most important institutions of justice in the United States. And if they decide to do so for mere political purposes, indeed, then we have reached a new stage in American politics, and not a very positive one.
But we seem to have reached a peculiar stage, though, already. When you think about how the Republicans, who used to be the cold warriors and some, and of course in the era of McCarthy, etc., were the red baiters. Now they're making excuses for the Russians. And then on the left, you've got people like Oliver Stone and the editors of The Nation magazine also making excuses for Putin. And nobody seems to care about the human rights situation in Russia that used to be what the focus of U.S. policy was during the Cold War in terms of putting pressure on the Soviets. I mean, for example, Navalny was just arrested. What's not reported is that Putin has Navalny's brother, who he's very close to, in prison in solitary confinement now for like over 3 years, just as a way to punish and put pressure on Navalny. I mean, we're talking about really thuggish operations going on, and there's not, I don't think, a sufficient outcry in this country. I mean, we talk about Russia becoming a kleptocracy of the Siloviki, etc., but on the other hand, I don't understand why both conservatives and liberals on the left basically make excuses for this regime.
It has been a very disturbing trend. I should emphasize, however, that the passage of the sanctions bill, which took away the President Trump's discretion and demanded that he consult with Congress, ultimately passed both houses of the U.S. Congress with overwhelming support. So there is still an element, I think, within both political parties that unites against the activities of Russia, especially its activities both in Ukraine and Crimea and internally inside the country. So I don't think, in many ways, you can argue that, at least in the current Congress, Russia was one of the few issues that united Congress to pass legislation that was veto-proof. So there is still a consensus within the majority in both houses that Russia needs to be confronted in its actions in its backyard. But you are right in terms of pointing out that as the Trump presidency has proceeded, there has been a change in the party, the Republican Party's perception of Russia, and there has been this perceived change that that they don't want the investigation about Russia's activities during the 2016 presidential campaign to impact the perception of President Trump and his ability to govern. And we are witnessing, you know, some recalculation of the politics of to what extent are we united, at least in terms of foreign policy, and to what extent do basic political considerations play in addressing the type of investigations that are being led by Mr. Mueller.
But in terms of the House and Senate overwhelmingly passing the legislation that circumscribed Trump's role and in terms of a Russian policy, which he objected to, you could also interpret that surely as that the very people we're talking about, the Congress and particularly the Republicans, who seem to be soft on the Russians, to use the old expression, soft on communism, they are also, I mean, you could interpret it as a rebuke of Trump in that they simply don't trust him.
Exactly. So I think it's an overstatement to say that the Republican Party, in terms of its attitude towards Russia, has gone soft. It's quite clear, however, in terms of the narrative about the investigation into collusion, that that has become a political football, and that the Republicans in Congress are not afraid to challenge some of the perceived underlying facts and the investigative bodies themselves in order to undermine the investigation.
But surely, just to put this into a broader context, William Pomerantz, it seems to me that there's a real struggle going on around the world between growing autocracy and a threatened democracy. And a couple of Harvard scholars have a new book out, How Democracies Die. I just interviewed him a couple of days ago, and it's quite alarming when you get the list of the autocracies, the Philippines and Turkey and others. And then on the left, they're under attack. Democracy's under attack in Venezuela, for example. So this is a global phenomenon, and the real question would be, we know that Putin's basically, and this motive has been attributed to the interference in the U.S. election, because I don't think he probably thought Trump would win. I think he imagined, like everybody else, that Hillary Clinton would win. But either way, he was going to make life miserable, and Trump would have been going around the country saying, lock her up for 4 years. And in general, the assumption is that he wants to hurt America, but also discredit democracy. And basically, the signal is that we just should accept this kind of gangster government. And that was, after all, the gangster government they had in Ukraine, which the Ukrainian people rose up against and led to this situation, that the current situation in Ukraine. So I think through that lens, I'd ask you two questions. One, do you think this is the ultimate struggle? And two, who's winning?
I think we are witnessing a struggle for the liberal democracies that emerged, particularly after the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe, and also a question about the viability of the underlying institutions in the United States. So far, there have been ways, at least in the United States, to fight back, to protest, to go to court, to use an independent media to try to address some of the issues that are being raised in terms of the Trump administration and its actions. But I do think President Putin, he is trying to identify how he can play on the global stage. And Russia doesn't really have an alternative ideology. It doesn't have a first-rate economy. But it does have is an ability to play on the fears of different people and to play on their fears in terms of how the world is changing, in terms of the composition of their nation, and how sovereignty is expressed globally. And Putin has been very successful in making what is a relatively small investment in terms of using disinformation and so forth to try to discredit these institutions. That being said, I don't think that Putin and Russia had the critical impact on the election that many suggest. Donald Trump managed to win that election on his own, both through dissatisfaction with the current regime and mistakes made by the Clinton administration, and the fact that he actually appealed to people that no one else was appealing to. So there is a question as to the underlying viability of democracy. And I think the real concern going forward is, to what extent does the United States want to be a leader in the world? I think when both the United States and Great Britain decide that they want to back away from the rules-based order and instead want to highlight notions of sovereignty to the point that that is the most important issue, and that, you know, no one should interfere in the domestic affairs of either the United Kingdom or the United States, then unfortunately we're talking Vladimir Putin's plan and not the traditional values that have been so successful since World War II.
Well, William Pomerantz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with William Pomerantz, who's Deputy Director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., and he also teaches Russian law at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.